Welcome to Impact, the Conservation Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Heimbuch. And if you are a visual storyteller with a love for all things wild, then you're in the right place. From conservation to creativity, from business to marketing, and everything in between, this podcast is for you, the conservation visual storyteller who is ready to make an impact. Let's dive in. Welcome to this episode of Impact, the Conservation Photography Podcast. And Roy Toft, I cannot tell you how excited I am to sit down and actually get to interview you for this. You have been on my list of photographers to interview for a long time. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, super sweet of you. And I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, I always ask the same question at the beginning of these, which is for anyone who hasn't seen your work or had the joy of being out on a tour with you, who is Roy Toft in the world?
I'm old. I've been around a while. Who is Roy Toft? Well, I grew up pretty much a Navy brat, so jumped around and then ended up in San Diego, California. And I was that weird kid on the block that had a garage full of snakes. Yep, that was me. So always loved animals and wanted to be a herpetologist when I grew up. I just thought snakes were it. And went to college for biology, wildlife biology. And then I found out, hey, you can see a lot more birds in a day than you can find snakes. So then I got into birds. And then from there, it just kind of grew as just, I love all animals and knew that I wanted to work with animals, didn't know how. I thought my perfect job would be a wildlife biologist out in the bush doing some relative conservation with animals. Then I find out those jobs are really hard to find. I mean, they're seasonal, they're 2-month project, and then you're looking for another grant. This was kind of the Reagan years. So yeah, not a lot of money for that. So my fallback was working at the wild animal park. And so started working at the wild animal park. And I know this was your first question, Jamie, and I'm already launching you into my life story.
I love it.
Is this what you want to know about Roy Toft? Like everything from the day I was born? Because it could be a while. So long story short, I went to work at the San Diego Wild Animal Park, which is kind of affiliated to the San Diego Zoo, which is a great facility. And so I could be around animals. I was a bird trainer. So I worked in a free flight bird show with 24 different species of raptors. So that was another fun thing. It was like being a falconer, but not really killing anything. And started photographing during that time. In fact, I received my first nice camera when I graduated from college in 1985. And then the day after graduating, I was in Alaska doing a wolf population study for you, it's Wildlife Service. So perfect. I'm in the middle of Alaska. I have a camera. We're collaring wolves and spent the summer doing that. So who is Roy Toft? Let's get back to the original question. I'm just a guy that loves animals, got into photography so I could be with animals, and luckily made a career out of it. And that's what I'm still doing. So kind of a simple guy. Not too complex, not a lot of synapses firing, but enjoys being in the wild, photographing wildlife.
Excellent.
Okay.
I love it. So that explains a lot because I remember seeing pictures of you working with wildlife, but not really realizing like how extensively you worked with wildlife. And then I was out on a trip with you in Costa Rica where we saw a viper, a pit viper. And you were just like, isn't it so pretty and sweet? And isn't it so, like, you were just so calm and happy. And you made me feel really calm and happy about this incredibly deadly snake. So how much does that like love of herpetology come in today? Because you also show videos all the time of you finding rattlesnakes on your property and moving them off to a safer place and just being really chill. How much does that kind of come into your photography now?
It comes into my photography a lot. I think it's a huge kind of responsibility if you're doing something like we do to kind of go against the sensationalism of encountering wildlife or being around wildlife. So much of what people see on the internet and even with some of the what we think of as documentary kind of programming. It's not that anymore. It's totally sensationalized. It's fear-based. It's, my gosh, look, this animal can kill me. And I just hate all that. I mean, it's anybody that spent any time in nature knows it's not like that. None of these animals want to get us. And unless you're trying to kill it or step right on it, nobody cares about harming us. And I think it's one of the best things we can do is just to normalize wildlife encounters and be, you know, thankful for them and to do those encounters in an ethical way and behave properly. And it can be so rewarding to have an encounter with a deer, with a raccoon, and just don't emphasize the danger of it, but kind of get excited about just having those encounters. So many of us don't have them anymore, and it's sad. And so people strive to have those encounters, but so much of what we see nowadays is negative press on any kind of wildlife encounters. I know your Coyote Project, everybody's, if you're on social media, I saw a coyote today and it wasn't afraid of me. Well, so what? Cool. Yeah. Does that automatically mean we should kill it? So, and I think snakes are, it's something where maybe a lot of people aren't as comfortable as I am, but I grew up with snakes. Like, there's no fear for me. There's respect, but there's no fear. They're not coming to get me. If I get hurt by one, it's going to be by my stupid trying to move them out of an area. All my neighbors call me for the rattlesnakes in their yard, and I go pick them up and relocate them. And hey, if I get bit, that's fine. That's on me. I mean, being comfortable with snakes, obviously you can get really great snake photos because you can go wide and close, which is always cool. Yeah.
And are you just always reading that behavior and noticing, oh yeah, the snake is feeling really calm, or this one's getting a little bit agitated? And so, because you've created stunning rattlesnake portraiture. And is that just a matter of knowing snakes really well?
Yeah, exactly. Just growing up with them. Mm-hmm. Body language or anything. If you have a dog or you have a cat at home, you know their body language. Maybe don't rub them on the belly right now because I'm going to get some claws. So same with snakes. I mean, they're pretty easy to read. And yeah, I get close, but still super respectful. And I don't want that striking picture. I don't want that jacked up rattlesnake defensive pose pictures. Those are, like, to me, so cliche and almost unethical at this point, because you had to push your luck so much to get that snake in a defensive posture. And it doesn't even, that's not what I want to convey. I'd rather have them just cruising over a boulder, flicking their tongue out and looking and being relaxed. That's really what they are most of the time.
Love that. I'd love for you to tell us a bit about where you live and the environment you live in, because your backyard seems like this magical wonderland of nature that you in part are responsible for curating, because you've really made it this like haven for wildlife. So can you tell us about your yard before we dive into like the beautiful conservation photography work you've brought out of your yard?
Sure. So I live in Southern California, North County of San Diego. So it's chaparral, which is kind of, people just think of as kind of scrubby brush, but it's really a beautiful, pretty evergreen environment. People think of San Diego as being brown most of the year. It is not. When you have climax bushes like ceanothus, our California lilac, laurel sumac, and scrub oak, all three of those large bushes stay green year round. So it's a beautiful environment. Huge boulders as big as your house. And you don't have to have a tiny house to have the boulder the size of it, because these are huge granite boulders. So if you can kind of picture that kind of environment, kind of hilly, we're at 1,500 feet. So lots of big boulders and kind of chaparral, big shrubby, kind of evergreen bushes around. So that's where I live. I'm super lucky that I live in kind of a very rural area. And we're lucky enough to have 28 acres that we call ours. although it's really for the animals. Being ours just means no other human can mess with it, but it's really for the animals. And a lot of my neighbors have large properties that are in green space. So even if they wanted to, they couldn't do much to that environment. And that sets up to have kind of a viable amount of property where animals can live and thrive and move through and utilize. So that's kind of where I am. And being a wildlife photographer and wildlife enthusiast, I've always kind of wanted to have bird feeders and hummingbirds around and planting plants that have some sort of nutrients for animals. And all my yard waste goes to these giant kind of yard piles on the outskirts. So a lot of people don't realize that those piles of branches are homes for things. And you don't need to mulch up everything. And nature doesn't have to be pristine and beautiful when it comes to our yard waste. So that's kind of where I am. 2 years after we moved here, it was a brand new house, and I was still kind of getting used to the environment. Our entire area burned down from a forest fire.
Oh, wow.
So before the fire, I couldn't really even walk in the valley. So I have a valley behind our house, and so thick, the chaparral hadn't burned in 50 years, which isn't normal for chaparral. It's definitely an environment that needs to burn or should burn every 15, 20 years to kind of keep it from being overgrown and too thick. So I couldn't even walk our property lines because it was so thick with scrub oak and ceanothus, and literally couldn't crawl through it. It was just a bramble of chaparral. After the fire, of course, nothing was there. It was ash, which seems super sad. And it was when you're living here, but it's supernatural phenomena in our environment. I mean, that's renewal, and everything grew back. It gave me an opportunity to actually get in the valley then and make a trail, because this environment's tough to move around without a trail. And if you start a trail before there's anything, it's really easier to maintain it. So I walked all through the valley and kind of mapped out this, it's a mile and a half trail through the valley. We have a kind of a seasonal creek that goes through the middle of the valley. And so I used that as kind of a common geographical feature to have a trail by, knowing wildlife's going to go there when there is water there. So that really set it up where I could enjoy the property more and put some camera traps out. And I played with camera traps many years ago with a project that I did. And it was a chance for me to get back into it. I hadn't done it in so long. And I knew camera traps, they just give you a glimpse into something, an environment you don't see all the time. Anything that's happening at night, you get to see that. Little slivers of time that animals move through a valley, we just don't get to witness that very often. We're off leading trips to Africa and running errands and working around the yard. We don't get to see a lot of our native wildlife because we're just not staring in the right places. And camera traps let you stare in the right places for hours and hours and hours and day and night and weeks and months. And I've had some of these camera traps out there 6 years now. And I've seen amazing stuff through these cameras, stuff that nobody would ever see. I don't know, if you're sitting in a blind for 6 years, you're not going to see this stuff. And that's really the beauty of it. And it's accessible to everyone. It's not this high-tech thing that only pros can do. Sure, if you're going to do DSLR, nice camera trap photos, that takes more energy. But if you just want to put a little video trail cam that costs $100, $150, it's just a wealth of excitement and entertainment just to watch what's going on. Even if you have a small trail behind your house, just to see what goes through there.
You have been a conservation photographer for years, and so I want to get into that journey. But before we do, I'm curious, did putting up camera traps in your yard and just seeing what's there and being able to sink into it and enjoy it, does that help keep you inspired or keep you excited about conservation photography? Or is it just kind of a fun extra element of your photography work?
Both. It's really both, because it's just fun. But as a conservation photographer, you and I know it can't be just fun. Like we want to go to the next level, right? So it does turn into work. It's not all fun and games. It's frustrating. You know, I just came back from 3 weeks leading a trip to Costa Rica and just couldn't wait to check. I have 5 high-end DSLR traps in the valley, strobes and pretty elaborate setups. Just couldn't wait to see the bounty of award-winning images and conservation photography I had. And it was just such a bust. And, you know, It's like this camera, second day after I left, failed for some reason. This transmitter failed. And that's what camera trapping is. It's a lot of, you're relying on a lot of technology that when it fails, it's kind of catastrophic for however long that you're not there. You're not getting any of the stuff you hope for. And for me, it's not that big a deal, right? I'm not on assignment. I'm not hiking 10 miles to get to my cameras. You know, it's not life or death. But that's 3 weeks of time. I wanted something good. Mm-hmm. And when technology kind of fails, you're kind of disappointed. So, you know, change batteries out, try to figure out what's not working. So that's all part of it. So it is just fun. But for me at this point, I'm in the process of doing a Wild Ramona book, which is mostly camera trap stuff, just because it's unique and it captivates people. Because it's a different look. And those of us in conservation photography, we're pretty blasé about camera trap stuff now. It's been around for a long time. A lot of the general public still doesn't see a lot of high-end camera trapping stuff. They see grainy black and white, like ring videos from their front door of a bobcat walking through their driveway. That's what a lot of the public sees. So when you show them a really high-end, high quality, wide angle, close up mountain lion that's in their community, but it really still blows them away. And so, I'm kind of on a quest now to up my game and see where I'm missing images for the book. And for me, it's kind of like this whole project. It's about engaging the community in wildlife, get them stoked about wildlife. We're a ranching community, pretty much. It's horse country where I live. There's still some of that bias of, well, no good predator. There's still some of that around. And I think people like myself, we can slowly change that, because there's not many ranchers that are actually making a living from having their cattle out there and losing a calf, and it's a big deal. It's just the mindset is still there. Of a mountain lion. Oh my gosh, we got to call someone. We need to take care of this. This isn't cool. Well, I'm here to say it is cool. We're super lucky that we have mountain lions still walking through our little community in Ramona. And there's hardly any negative downsides to that. It's just a cool thing. So, so that's what I'm doing now. It's kind of when I'm home, it keeps my juices flowing, because before this kind of Wild Ramona backyard project, running trips, running photo workshops and trips is really what I do to pay the bills, and was only my only real outlet for being a photographer, continuing to be a photographer, is shooting when I'm out with my clients. So now I get to be a real conservation photographer again in the field doing stuff and see where it goes.
I'm so excited that you are putting together a book, because I have your book on the Osa Peninsula, which is an area of Costa Rica that you created a gorgeous photography book about. And I'm kind of curious, because you said something earlier. You said we're wildlife photographers, but as conservation photographers, we know that the photography is, that's not the end all be all. There's more to it than that. How did you know that you wanted to focus on conservation as a wildlife photographer? Did you have a realization moment, or what was that journey like?
I think my background was in wildlife biology. And so I think there's two ways that people come into wildlife photography. You either come into it as a wildlife biologist, loving the animal side of it, and then photography is just a way for you to do that, or you're really enamored by photography and art and that, and you learn about the animals. So I was definitely the former. So conservation photography was an easy jump for me. That's my passion. You know, I wanted to be a wildlife biologist. Those are my heroes, not photographers per se. It's the George Schallers of the world. You know, those are my heroes. The E.O. Wilsons, those guys are my rock stars, not some great photographer that can make a really pretty picture. I know how hard it is to make a pretty picture. It's not easy, but at the end of the day, I'd rather, hey, my mentor was Nick Nichols from Nat Geo, and there's rarely a pretty picture you're going to find of his. They're all just gritty and, man, dark and dirty and wild. That's what I hope to be like more. You know, I see so many pretty pictures nowadays. A lot of it has to do with the kind of post-processing that we're doing. We can clean up anything nowadays. Since I lead tours, a lot of photo tours, the bird photography nowadays in all these locations on the most beautiful moss-covered branch with one fern, same branch for all the photos. I mean, yeah, I've shot that too because my people want to shoot it and we're there. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a feeding situation, right? It's you're at these places where they're feeding the birds. But man, it's so like, come on, it's too beautiful and too like another beautiful setting with not, that's, I don't know, that's not me. I mean, I want more natural, wild stuff. I get it. I get where people want the cleanest, most beautiful things to post on Instagram. But boy, give me a, yeah, down and dirty camera trap picture with distractions galore, and it says something, and there's emotion there. Yeah, give me that.
Nice. I love it. When you think about the journey that you've had as a conservation photographer, and then today really using your backyard to think about how you can bring your community on board with things like predators, like mountain lions and bobcats and healthy rattlesnake populations, where do you as a conservation photographer kind of go mentally? Because you lead tours all over the world, but conservation is always on your mind. So as you're out and you're seeing so much potential for photography to make a difference, whether it's in areas where you lead tours or right at home, where do you personally want to put your effort these days?
Right now, I mean, it's this backyard project for me. I'm not a photographer that can have a million things in the air. That's just not the way I work. So I'm just focused on this kind of backyard project. I mean, we were just in Costa Rica, and, you know, and my group of clients going there helps support a turtle program that goes there on that OSA Conservation does. I bring all my folks there, and they're releasing turtles, and they do a great work. So I mean, my people are putting money into those projects just by going there. And can I do more? Yeah. Can we all do more? Yeah. But so much of what our wild areas need is resources and people to care about them. The places we go, I try to be really thoughtful and go to places where that money goes to the right places, because it's substantial. You know, these trips aren't cheap. People that have cameras now, and there's a zillion of them, a lot of them, they have time, they have money. That's the perfect formula for running these tours, is these clients have time and money, and you have to put them in places where they can make a difference. And it's a perfect place to kind of talk about conservation. Because if you get these people on board, they can make a difference. Where we go in Africa, I mean, these private concessions, without tourists going there, without us crazy photographers going there, no one protects these areas. Everything has to have a dollar amount, unfortunately, everything has to have a dollar amount behind it for local people to really care. Most of the rest of the world, they're not like us. They're worried about that roof of their head and where the next meal's coming from. And if conservation through tourism can bring that, they're mm-hmm. on board. But I need to do more. I think I need to do more.
Well, it's funny because I feel like I see you and so many other conservation photographers doing a lot for conservation. And yet it always comes down to this idea of I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. But I think that that's just our mindset of being someone who wants to make a difference and always seeing opportunities. Do you think that that's true? What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I mean, so much of what we do, it's like it doesn't have the, you know, that finale where we really feel like we did something. Think of, you know, the mega transect with Nick Nichols, with Nat Geo and Mike Fay. That huge project with a lot of money behind it created huge national parks through Gabon and Central Africa that weren't there. Like, we all want to do that, you know? It's like, God, why can't? But yeah, we all can't be Mike Fay and Nick Nichols. So I think most of us, we do what we can. We do these little things with never feeling like it's enough. Some of us are certainly more of an activist, I would say. I think of like someone like Amy Gulick, her salmon project with the bears through the Tongass. It is amazing that she keeps up that momentum. And I think more of us would like to do more what she's doing, where we feel, because I look at her work and I'm just like, man, to have that concentration and not jump. I'm jumping everywhere and I lose concentration because I think when you run these trips, it really sucks up a lot of your time. And passion projects and projects that could really mean something down the road, you don't put enough time into it, make it go anywhere. And so I think that's a drawback to running trips. But yeah, you got to pay the bills. You know, we got to do what we can do. And I know how to do trips. I think I'm good at it. I think people mm-hmm. enjoy it. I'm not for everyone, that's for sure. And that goes both ways for clients and me too. But so yeah, I think I can't be alone. Someone that wants to do more, but you just feel like, oh, I guess I'm just running another trip. And I shouldn't negate that, what I do. I shouldn't be like, oh, I only do this. But I think that's just part of who we individually are, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I do think you shouldn't negate what it is that you do, because I feel like it's very important to bring that conservation element into wildlife photography trips, because there's many, many trips that don't think about that, that don't introduce people to these concepts or run even unethical tours. And you do such an incredible job. And I want to dive into your tours particularly, because I think that you do a beautiful job of not only giving people a great experience that feels really amazing as photographers, with like, it's lucrative in terms of the images that you bring back from one of your tours, but you're always talking about conservation. You're always talking about what the species are going through, or like the example that you gave about your tour directly helps turtle conservation, or you're building conservation into that. And that's no small thing, I think. I think that that is really critical. When you're thinking about the tours that you're lining up, do you actively think about the conservation element that you might want to bring into it? Or is that something that just sort of naturally comes about as you're planning or scouting?
It just naturally comes in. Obviously, there's so much that goes into a trip and making it successful for people. And there's just so many elements that have to come together. And there's always a conservation angle to every place we go. And I mean, there's not a place in the planet that doesn't have a conservation topic glued to it. And if there's wildlife involved, there is, right? And we're trying to bring people to a place that in a relatively short time, a week or two, they can get a well-rounded experience of what wildlife in that area is and be successful at it in a short amount of time. And there's limited places in the world where you can do that and be successful. That's why a lot of us are doing very similar trips. But I think every tour leader can bring their own ethics, their own background, their own personal experience into that tour, and it can make a difference. A million people run trips in Costa Rica. I mean, I've been doing trips there. That was my 24th year doing photo workshops, where you and I went several years back in the Osa Peninsula. So I've been doing it a long time. But I see so many trips there, and the staggering images that some of these tour groups come back with. But then I'm a photographer. I know that everything is set up. Everything's sitting in a room with 10 flashes around a flower and a hummingbird coming into it. Everything's in a blind. We're 10 photographers sitting there shooting king vultures as they come into a dead goat. It just goes on and on. Like, that's not what I want to do with my group. I don't want to, you know, I always tell my people, it's so much more important to come home with a feeling, a sense of an area, coming home with knowledge of how you can troubleshoot and make images in your own backyard. That's way more important than coming home with 30 amazing pictures that you're going to post and you're going to forget about. But I think for so many people, it's definitely quantity of images and just, what's my haul from this workshop? I paid this amount. And that's just the wrong way of thinking about wildlife photography. Like, it's not a high percentage shoot. Wildlife, we work hard for every great image. It's, you know, it's not a, I need 10 great shots today. Give me all toucans that live here. I want every monkey. How many snakes do we have in cages? All right. I want a great picture of every snake that we can put on this branch, and every, you know, red-eyed tree frog that we've caught and stuck on a beautiful flower. I mean, that's not wildlife photography. That's a model photo shoot. And it's just, it kind of bastardizes, I think, what wildlife photography is. Now, nothing against those people. I mean, if it's done ethically, I just have a hard time. That kind of imagery, do those people really know and love the place they're going, or they purely go home knowing and loving these amazing pictures they have? Mm-hmm. There's a huge difference there. Huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is. I feel like there are differences in wildlife photographers and what people want to experience in a place. And so the more that we can get tour leaders who are focusing on conservation, focusing on the idea of, like, you're here to experience and understand a location every bit as much, if not more, than the images that you create while you're there. Because you can take those images that every single person at that tour is going to walk away having, and there isn't a whole lot of joy to me behind those pictures that are, they're images that everybody got. There's nothing unique about it. There's nothing interesting. There's not a story behind it, because everything was created for you. Whereas when you can head out on a different type of workshop where a sense of place, where experience, where understanding the species that live there and witnessing them is really emphasized, then you bring home unique images. Everyone might get kind of similar-ish images, but not necessarily the same shot. And it's the story of, oh, and then we found this sloth, and then we stopped and watched it for a while, and then it did this, and then it did that, and it was so cool. And remember when we high-fived each other? You know, you come home with that kind of vibe instead. And that, I think, means so much. And different wildlife photographers are going to have a different connection with that. But I think that the listeners of this podcast anyway are going to really relate to the idea of, I went and learned about a place. It felt like I was contributing or understanding or being immersed in it. And that's what is attached to the images that we bring home. That experience?
I totally agree. I mean, that OSA trip, like, I just got back from that. And at the end of the week, everybody puts in 10 pictures, and not necessarily their best stuff. And I like emphasize, do not spend 10 hours in post-processing, because it's not a critique. It's that week of shooting at that locale. everybody gets different pictures because it's, okay, what's fruiting here? You know, nothing's set up, you know, except for, yeah, I might have a frog here. So, okay, let's learn some macro. But most of it's just, okay, let's see what's fruiting in the garden. Toucans are coming in here. And everybody gets different stuff. And it blows me away to see those images at the end of the week because someone really gets into the macro and spends hours in the forest finding cool stuff. And it's the story. It's the experience behind and overcoming the, as photographers, we always have all these kind of hurdles we have to get over to get to an image we like. And there's all these things we have to overcome, both technically and compositionally. And if you let people figure those out on their own, that sense of accomplishment, and they're a better photographer. Instead of just sitting in a chair, give them a cable release and say, when the hummingbird's close, push this button. You're going to get an amazing picture. All your followers are going to love this picture. Never can redo it at home. Have no idea what's going on. Like, yeah, my clients, and not just me, but there's a lot of great photo leaders. But I'm just saying, I hope the trend isn't towards this sterilized setup, super high probability. People are going to come away with a million great shots, but not have any experience. Like, it's just not what it's about. It's not what it's about. And I just hope it doesn't go that route, because I think a lot of people, they can fall into that. And this, they might think this is what a photo workshop is, and either be turned off by it and not go with someone that's different, more like what they want to be, someone that just might know the area and put some in cool situations. And it might happen, it might not, but we're in a good spot. This is what wildlife photography is about. We've put ourselves in this great spot and we've done our homework, and it might pay off, it might not. We don't have piles of food out there. We don't know if this thing's going to come back, but yeah, this is what a wildlife photographer does. I hope there's more people that want to get into doing tours that just realize there's a real benefit to that. It doesn't have to be get these people 20 different species a day for them to be happy. People will be happy with a lot less if you give them the experience of what being a real wildlife photographer is about.
I also think that the idea of, oh, I want these 20 species, that's trophy hunting. It's just trophy hunting with a camera.
Well, that's where we're going. Really? I mean, look at a lot of these tours now. Social media doesn't help. Just got to have a beautiful picture to post and don't care about what's involved behind it. Luckily, you know, a lot of this, the game farm thing, you know, I don't want to get into a lot of that, but that's kind of going away with, you know, a lot of very passionate people really pushing that needle. And I think, I hope some of the workshop stuff can go that way too, as far as just, well, it doesn't have to be so sterilized and so total goal orientated on a zillion high-end images from every workshop. Doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. Well, so you lead tours all over the world. You're all over the place. Can you tell me more about what some of your tours are around the world? Because I'm sure that there are listeners who are like, yes, that's the experience I want. I want to go and explore and be immersed and learn the how and why, and not focus so much on trophy images that come home, but I really want to come home as a better photographer who experienced a place. Tell us more about the tours that you lead and where people might go with you.
Okay. So you mentioned Africa. So I've been leading trips to Botswana for the last 20 plus years. And I got connected to Botswana. It's an intimate African experience as far as a country goes. Their model for tourism is quite a bit different than East Africa, where most people are thinking about Kenya or Tanzania, which are wonderful destinations to go, but they're just different. You know, it's much more about higher numbers of people, much more of a national park experience where you're waiting at a gate in the morning. You get let in, do your thing with a lot of other people, and then you got to race to the gate by sunset. not all the places are like that, but that's a lot of East Africa's that based. Botswana is boutique lodges, usually 12 beds or less, 16 beds or less, four vehicles max. And it's on a concession. It's not a national park. So it's land leased from the government. Big acreage, you know, 40,000 acres, big chunks of land. And it's just for that one lodge. So they have a 10-year lease and that's all you're going to see on that land. So basically my group rolls in, we take over the whole lodge and we have four vehicles. We go separate directions within radio because, you know, you want everybody to be on a great sighting. But I want all my people to be out there in nature and tracking and trying to feel the pulse of Africa and not purely looking for a Land Rover that stopped and you know they have something and globbing onto their sighting. And that's pretty much what East Africa is. I mean, you don't find a lot of your own stuff in East Africa. You get a call or you see 10 vehicles around something, go there. They got something good. And that's not what really being a photographer, I don't think. So Botswana suits me. It's small, amazing wildlife, and you have to work for it. There's not 100,000 wildebeests in front of you. We can spend 3 hours tracking a leopard and may not find it. And there's no one else to call. Well, my people will call, but we don't have many vehicles out there. So that limits the amount of eyes. So it's just fun. It's much more, I think, an authentic experience for people. So I just love that. So that's Botswana. Mm-hmm. And you still want to hear more?
Yes, I do. Okay. I'm already like, oh my gosh, okay, I need to go check out the next opening. Because you're booked out through 2024 at this point, right?
Yeah, we're just opening a second trip in 2024 because we filled up super, super quick. So, wow. And yeah, lucky for that. And a lot of people that have been to Botswana with me already 4 or 5 times. So it's one of those kind of places. You definitely don't want to just go once. It's special. Mm-hmm. So then I also go to Chile, Patagonia for mountain lions or pumas. It's the only place in the world you can photograph pumas during the day in a relaxed, basically following them through that environment, beautiful Patagonia environment. It's purely a situation where through the years there's habituation, you know, these cats aren't persecuted in these areas and they get used to this little group of 5 people kind of following at a respectful distance and being quiet and squatting down and photographing them. And so really a fly on the wall experience. And that's wonderful. This will be my 9th year coming up doing that. And that is a really unique experience for a lot of reasons. One, we actually get to be walking. Hardly any tours you're walking anywhere. You're always in boats, you're in vehicles, and so to actually be out physically exerting yourself in this environment, it's a really wild experience. You feel like you're in this environment. And it's a harsh environment. It's windy, it's cold, the weather can change any minute. So that's really fun. And so I do that. And then I'm also doing Brazil like a million other people at this point for Jaguars. And, you know, I think it was probably Joe McDonald and myself that were the first to start leading trips there for photographers. It's been since 2009 for me. And I know Joe was right around there, Joe and Marion. Yeah, great experience. I mean, I keep waiting for it not to be good anymore because it's a little crazy now. A lot of people go there. Mm-hmm. But to see wild jaguars along a river hunting caiman and mating and being relaxed, it's just as a nature enthusiast and a photographer, 20 years ago was something none of us could thought would ever exist. Jaguars were the new world ghost cat, just like pumas. You just don't see them. And now we have 2 places on the planet where we can actually see pumas, walk with them, photograph them, watch them hunt, watch them with their babies, totally relaxed, ethical, terrific. And Brazil is much the same way. You're on the river system, you have clients in boats, and you're following jags and finding them along the coastline, the rivers. It's just magical. It can be a lot of people nowadays. You know, you can have 10 boats, 15 boats, the same cat, and I'm waiting for that circus to get out of hand. But every year I go back, I have a wonderful time. The majority of companies now working there, they realize that's their golden goose. The boat drivers keep people from doing wrong things. Everybody's quiet. It's still a great experience. So I do that. What else am I doing? Costa Rica. I'm doing India about every other year for tigers. I've been doing some snow leopards, which is a whole nother challenge. I've done 3 snow leopard trips up in the Himalayas. So yeah, those are most of the ones that are keeping me busy.
Wow.
There's always an odd one here or there.
Right. Oh, man. So I have at least one more question for you before I let you go. You have been all over the world and you've had years of experience and getting to be out in nature. Like, I feel like you are just constantly on the go. Do you still have bucket list places where you're like, I definitely know that I want to go to this place. I've never been there before and I got to see it.
Well, there are some places, but the places that I want to go now are a lot of work, you know? And so that's getting older. It's challenging to think of, because I want wild places. We have a lot of wilderness areas that aren't so wild anymore. And I want to go to like wild places in Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. And I've been to those places, some of those places, but I haven't done it well. Those wild places need time and money and logistics, and think of a Nat Geo assignment 20 years ago where they really threw in like, you're going to do it right. That's what I want to do. You know, like what Tim Lehman did with Birds of Paradise in Papua New Guinea. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my dream. Sit in a blind 150 feet up in a tree and watch a lek of Birds of Paradise. So I don't know if those kind of dreams are still viable for me at my age. But yeah, just like not too long ago, I kind of started a Harpy Eagle project where it was kind of a passion project. And spent, you know, a fair amount of time and effort and money to get up into trees and photograph harpy eagles. And some of the most rewarding moments of my life were in those blinds watching what I think is arguably one of the sexiest, most powerful birds in the world do what it does. And so, yeah, I want to do those experiences. They're still out there. I just, it's not getting any easier.
It's never ending adventure as long as you have that mindset, that mentality, I think. And it feels really good to hear someone like you where it's like, what hasn't Roy done in this world? Still say, oh no, there's adventures out there they're on the books for sure. It's awesome. Well, Roy, for those listeners who are really excited to see more of your work, to check out the Osa Peninsula book or the upcoming Wild Ramona book, to check out all of your tours, where do they go to find you?
I have a website. It's Toff Photo Safari, or just Roy Toft. You can find Toff Photo. And also on Instagram, I'm posting a bunch of stuff. So that's Toft Photo Safaris. And yeah.
Perfect.
You can find what I'm doing there. You know, I'm so high tech, you know, with the social media, and there's probably some TikToks out there I'm doing. I don't know. No, it ain't going to happen. I'm still trying to figure out what a reel is. What is a reel?
Well, in the show notes, I will have links to everything. So anyone who's not feeling particularly high tech, you just scroll down from the show notes and the links will be right there to go check out Roy's work. Thank you so much for spending time with me. And thank you for being someone that I have admired my entire, like once I figured out, oh, this thing called conservation photography exists, you were one of the first people whose work I learned about. And I've been admiring you literally my entire career. And I am so grateful for you and thankful that I've been able to go out in the field with you.
Ah, you're so sweet. Well, let's get back in the field.
Okay.
Grab that kidney.
I'm ready.
Come on down here and do some wild Ramona with me.
All right. Look out. It'll be me and Nick with some surfboards and camera equipment. Just headed your way. Nick
can cook some mean food and give us a great massage. So bring them.
All right. Wonderful. Roy, you are awesome. Thank you so, so very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Jamie.
All right. And everyone, we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you so much for listening to the very end of this episode. And I want to give you a reward for the attention and the dedication that you just showed. I have made something extra special for you. It is a 45-second quiz that reveals your unique personality as a visual storyteller. See, as photographers and filmmakers, we all have our own unique creative strengths as well as some weaknesses to be aware of. And this quiz will not only reveal your creative super strengths, but also provide you with a customized action plan to put those strengths into action. You can head to jamieh.com/quiz to find out your unique storyteller personality. That's jamieh.com/quiz. I hope that you have so much fun learning about the unique personality that you bring to your storytelling.